All right. All right. Well, those who have joined us, who have joined us, and those who have not, but they'll be in here shortly. So why don't we begin this very, very important panel? We can actually begin it with a chant. And when our movement is under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back. What do we do? And that's what we do. We stand up, fight back. So for those of you who do not know me, I'm Mick Kelly. I was one of the anti-war 23. When I'm a speaker, I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But we have a group of very, very important panelists right here today, and I advise you strongly to give them your undivided attention. We have some cases that are of great political importance for our entire movement. And we know that when we have an effective movement, we also face repression. The two things go together, being effective on one hand and facing repression on the other hand. They're like twins, and we can and will defeat repression. As I was just saying a few moments ago, that we aim to have an effective movement. We stand against American wars, and we stand with Palestine, and we stand with all oppressed. We're serious. We're absolutely serious about our commitment to liberation. And we understand that one of the impacts, one of the effects of being effective people, effective organizer, organizing an effective movement, is that we can and will face repression. Now, we've been seeing that in the Palestine movement. We've seen people losing their jobs. We've seen people being pushed off the college campuses, seen attempts to have our rights taken away. And it's vital that each and every case of repression be met with resistance and determined resistance at that. And at this point, I'm going to begin my presentation, and I'm going to be introducing the other speakers. But for those of you who do not know me, I'm Mick Kelly, and I was one of the anti-war 23. It was a group of activists, international solidarity and anti-war folks, trade unionists and others, who on September 24th, were raided by the FBI and subsequently subpoenaed to a grand jury. On the morning of September 24th, what happened is this. About 70 agents accompanied by other folks in law enforcement fanned out around the country and began carrying out raids on offices and homes, including my own. And there's some other people in this room who are in the case. There's Meredith Abbey right there. Do you want to stand up, Meredith? Meredith's home was one of the folks raided by the FBI. What, you had a couple dozen agents at your house? Something like that. There's Sarah Martin over here. Sarah was, I don't see her. Sarah, stand up. Sarah was called to a grand jury in Chicago, and they were very serious about putting her in prison, and she stood up to the grand jury. Tom Burke, who's over here, he's on the stage with me. He's another person who was called to the grand jury and successfully resisted. So we have a lot of people. Is there other people involved in the case? I don't see any, but there's a lot of us. So if I overlooked somebody, I'm truly sorry. But so what happened at my house on the morning of September 24th was this. I wasn't there. Just wasn't there. I was at work in a kitchen. But at home, my partner was there, and suddenly she heard pounding on the door. And the voice, this is the FBI. She wanted to see the warrant, but instead of seeing the warrant, what happened is they used a battering ram to knock down the door, smashed a fish tank, and suddenly the place was full of an FBI SWAT team. And this was repeated in other places around the country. And it was a dramatic set of raids that was designed to put anti-war and international solidarity activists in jail. So if you look at the warrant for my house, and the houses of the others, it basically was looking at a case of material support for terrorism. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But material support of terrorism is basically a thought crime. It says that if you stand in solidarity, effective solidarity, with the National Liberation Movement, we will put you in jail, and we will put you in jail for a very long period of time. So the groups mentioned on my warrant were the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, it's the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. And last but not least, Hezbollah. But the thing about this is this, and that is that I think all those are great groups full of great people doing great things. And I'd never made a secret of that point of view. Never made a secret. You could look on the internet. You could see pictures of me with Leila Khaled from the Popular Front. It's not, whatever, it's not hidden. It's not concealed, nothing about it. But what the Effective Death Penalty and Prevention of Terrorism Act does, it makes it a crime to carry out effective solidarity with national liberation movements. And it's very, very important that it be opposed, and it's a very, very serious charge. Typically, and Mel could talk about this more, every count of material support carries 15 years. Typically, those who are charged are convicted, and those who are convicted end up in what's called a control unit once you get to prison. That's basically a prison within a prison, usually for Muslims. And that's just a reality of America today. We were effective in defeating those charges. And actually, quite truthfully, we were never charged. But we were effective in pushing back against those charges. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the lessons of that, because I think they're applicable for other cases. You know, one is that we were absolutely determined to resist. Not one person testified in front of the grand jury. And for those of you, I think most of you know about grand juries, but for those of you who do not, let me say this. If you get to a grand jury and you don't talk, you can be put in prison. It's actually just that simple. It's meant to be coercive. In other words, they can hold you until they decide that, well, you're never going to talk, and at that point they're supposed to let you go. But it's a very serious thing. All 23 of us refused to testify in front of the grand jury. So that resistance and public resistance was actually vital to our success. Number two, we had an approach of relying on the masses of people. I have only 5 minutes left. And by that, I mean we had to go out in a very big way to bring the broadest possible support around our case. And I think we were very effective in that. We held regional conferences. We formed something called the Committee to Stop FBI Repression. Hundreds of people attended those conferences. We got the endorsement or support from trade unions, trade unions representing about 500,000 people. We sent delegations to Congress to push about our case. And every step of the way, we did everything possible to say the democratic rights of those who want to resist imperialism are under attack. We tried to build as big as possible tent to unite as all who can be united to push back against these charges. And I think that was successful. And finally, we had a good legal strategy that was aggressive, that did things like push back, like the Justice Department had my passport, not just mine, others too. We pushed back legally against that. And we pushed back actually at every single point that we could and had an aggressive strategy that was all about defending our rights. Now, our case was linked with a group of others, and this went on for about 8 years. And I'm not going to be able, for the standpoint of time, to recall all of them, but the two key ones in this is Carlos Montes, former leader of the Brown Berets, who was raided in Los Angeles in 2012, and then Rismio Da, who ended up not doing any jail time or a minimal amount, was eventually deported. But in all those cases, I think the fundamental principles are the same. We need to mobilize people. We need to be aggressive, draw people into motion, and have effective legal strategies. So those are the basic points and basic lessons that I wanted to hit on. I think I have not used my 10 minutes in its entirety. So that being the case, I want to be a positive example, not just kind of a do what I say to do. But I'm going to take it to the other speakers. And the first, I'm done. I'm introducing Dr. Fields. And Dr. Fields has some impressive credentials, and let me actually look down and see what they might be. She's from I'm serious. And just to go a little bit off script here, I consider the case that Dr. Fields is going to be speaking on one of the most important cases taking place in the U.S. today in terms of pushing back against repression. It has actually, to me, a very similar feel to some of my own experiences. So Dr. Fields is a National Central Committee member of the African People's Socialist Party and the director of the All African People's Party Development and Empowerment Project. So please, give it up for Dr. Fields and listen to this important case.
Uhuru. Don't be afraid. Uhuru. Okay, for those of you who may not know, Uhuru is a Kiswahili word that means freedom. And it's the word that we use in our movement, not only to identify the movement itself, but to greet each other, because we believe that freedom has to be on the minds of African people and all colonized people and all freedom-loving people 24 hours a day, okay? So don't be afraid to respond with Uhuru when I greet you that way. Uhuru. Uhuru, thank you. I bring freedom greetings on behalf of the National Central Committee of the African People's Socialist Party and our chairman, Omalia Shetela, and the wider international Uhuru movement. Before I begin my presentation, I want to express the unconditional unity of our party and our people with the righteous struggle of the Palestinian people. Fighting against genocidal white settler state of Israel. And we declare, as we always have as the African People's Socialist Party, that there must be victory for the Palestinian people from the river to the sea. So we stand with you. So the African People's Socialist Party is more than 50 years old, and it's led by our chairman, Omalia Shetela. The theory that leads the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru movement is called African internationalism. This is a theory that explains the world, and it explains the role of African people in this world. As African internationalists, we recognize that capitalism was born as a world economy and that it has its origin in the assault of Africa and in the global trade of African human beings, as well as the ensuing European onslaught on most of the world. For our party and movement, practice is primary. So for more than five decades, we've built a variety of organizations, campaigns, and economic institutions, and have championed and led around the cause of reparations for African people. We have built a solidarity movement of white people, members of the colonizer nation, who actually fight against colonialism and work in the white community to win the question of unity through reparations. Our party built the first World Tribunal for Reparations to African People in New York in 1982. Where the U.S. government was found guilty of committing genocide against African people based on international law and was found to owe us at least $1.2 trillion for labor alone. Our chairman, Omalia Shetela, is a former member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He's 82 years old, and he's a political theorist and strategist who has traveled to over 19 countries, building the Black Power struggle throughout Africa, Europe, and the Americas, and establishing solidarity relations with other colonized peoples and their movements. He has driven the establishment of over 50 Black community economic institutions designed to free African people from the colonial mode of production and from welfare slavery. Today, we see that as the struggle of colonized people for liberation and self-determination intensifies, so does the counterinsurgency, or the efforts to repress the leaders, the organizations, and the masses of people who are fighting to be free. And as we organize to deconstruct this global system of colonial domination, we must be serious in our efforts to defend the movement, to push back the colonial state, and to continue to advance the struggle that ultimately is about making sure that the colonized people of the world have access to our land, our labor, and our resources. In June of 2022, I was sent by our party to our headquarters in St. Louis to help coordinate a program developed under the leadership of our deputy chairwoman called the African Doula Project. This project was a part of our party's multifaceted economic development and anti-gentrification project known as the Black Power Blueprint. The African Doula Project itself is a first step towards building an African Women's Center in St. Louis. We in the African Doula Project provided 14 African working class women in the North Side with the training needed to become full spectrum doulas as part of an effort to address the high rates of infant and maternal mortality in the African community in St. Louis. On July 2nd, 2022, while we were in St. Louis, we got word that a man with a military-grade flamethrower set fire to the huge red, black, and green African national flag that was flying high over our Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida. 4 weeks later, around 5 a.m. on July 29th, the morning of our doula training, The U.S. government attacked us with a violent FBI raid on 7 offices and homes of African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru Movement leaders, including the home of our chairman and our deputy chairwoman, Ona Zenaya Shetela, in St. Louis, the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida, and the Uhuru Solidarity Center in St. Louis. Chairman O'Malley, Deputy Chair Ona, and others were handcuffed with assault rifles pointed at them while the FBI used flashbang grenades, drones, battering rams, breaking down doors and windows, and covered up security cameras as they stole property, computers, phones, files, archives, and more. 2 months later, in September of 2022, Change.org removed our Africans Charged Genocide petition that had over 130,000 signatures from people uniting with our call to charge the U.S. government with genocide against African people. On October 31st, 2022, activist Timba Shabanda was arrested while volunteering in our community garden in St. Louis on a bogus charge of making terroristic threats. He was held for at least 2 weeks, being interviewed by the FBI agents before being released. In December of 2022, we received word that indictments and arrests of 4 unindicted co-conspirators were imminent. On January 7, 2023, the church across the street from our chairman, which was under contract by our movement to build a community center, was burnt to the ground. On February 8, 2023, the FBI was slammed in a St. Louis alderman meeting. And the next day, on February the 9th, the State Department announced a $10 million reward for anybody with information that could help their case against us. A few days later, on February 14th, Pinellas County Board of Supervisors revoked funding for Black Power 96 FM radio, a low-power FM radio station that our party has operated for many years. On March 7th, we held a webinar that showed that the U.S. government was actually imposing sanctions against our movement, economic sanctions similar to those that are imposed on foreign countries that are not subservient to U.S. domination. Some of those attacks included Regions Bank closing our movement accounts, closing our credit lines despite having put hundreds of thousands of dollars in those accounts, calling back a mortgage that, you know, we had never been late on. Facebook blocked the ability for our organizers to crowdfund. GoFundMe stole $9,000 from our fund to be able to do a legal defense of our movement, and Stripe temporarily blocked sustaining donations. With the threat of charges for 9 months looming over our head on April 18th, the chairman, Omalia Shetela, and the African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess, and Uhuru Solidarity Member Movement Chair Jesse Neville were indicted on bogus DOJ charges of being Russian agents. Known as the Uhuru 3, the indictment charges Omalia Shetela, Chairman of our African People's Socialist Party, Chairwoman Penny, and Comrade Jesse with conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States, acting as agents of the Russian government as they face a maximum prison sentence of 15 years on these completely bogus charges. The activities that serve as the basis for these charges include our work to run candidates for local election on a campaign of Black community control of the police and reparations to the African community, and work that we had done to charge the United States government with genocide to the UN. It must be said that the case of Uhuru 3 threatens the future of First Amendment speech protections for everybody, as everything the DOJ accuses our comrades of is supposed to be protected speech, speaking, broadcasting, or printing dissenting opinions. And the DOJ is trying to redefine disinformation, writing in their arguments that legally prohibited disinformation does not necessarily mean information that's not true, only that it may undermine trust in the U.S. sanctions, support for Western democracies, et cetera. So I want to just say that there's a lot more we can say about this case. In the interest of time, I want to tell folks where we are and what we can do. Right now, we have trial that's set to happen in Tampa Federal Court in September 3rd. We're calling everybody all out for the trial in Tampa. If you can make it, this trial is set to be about a month long, starting on September 3rd. If you can make it for a day, if you can make it for 3 days, if you can make it for a week, if you can make it for the entire trial, we're calling on you to come and show your support for the Uhuru 3 there. We also have a table that's set up in the lobby. This is a table of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, white members of our Solidarity Movement who are working in the interest of bringing white people into the leadership of fighting against colonialism. So we want to invite you to go to that table and get more information about this case. And also, you should check out our website, handsoffuhuru.org. There you can donate to our legal defense. You can sign our emergency pledge, sign our online petition, and you can join the coalition that we formed to do the fight back and make sure that our comrades, our chairman, Omalia Shetella, Chairwoman Penny Hess, Chair Jesse Neville, don't see one day in prison. I want to thank UNAC for the opportunity to participate in this important conference. I want to thank all of you, many of you, who I know have played some role, even up to now, to defend the Uhuru 3, and I want to ask you to continue to show that support. Let's push back the state. Let's tell the United States government that we will not accept one day in jail for Chairman Omalia Shetella, Penny Hess, or Jesse Neville. Hands off Uhuru, hands off Africa. Uhuru.
Genuine heroes for standing up. Genuine heroes. Okay. The next speaker, and we have Stop Cop Cities, very, very important struggle. Revifa Wangaza, who's going to be talking to us today about this important, important battle that's been taking place in Atlanta and beyond. So here she is. Warm welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, some struggles we defend against by preventing them from arising altogether. When we recognize the fact that we're engaged in a 500-year battle against a military onslaught against humanity, then we never let down our guard. The United States is an ongoing criminal enterprise built with stolen labor on stolen land, and by definition must maintain a military presence and coercive atmosphere in order to exist at all. My father used to say to us during the 1960s when I was young and full of vinegar and knew everything, "What do you think we've been doing all these years?" One of the things that we need to do in order to prevent to engage in prevention is to know our history, to know the history of struggle in this country, to know the history of struggles. Let me hear you say struggles. Yeah. We have a tendency to think that the one we're engaged in or focused on is the only one. But when we understand that we're engaged with an octopus, we understand that there are many struggles going on at the same time, and it's the head of that one octopus with all those arms that is manipulating us all. And unless and until we recognize that fact, we are playing whack-a-mole. We've put out the struggle in Palestine, or sort of kind of put it out in South Africa, but then we look and there's Haiti, there's the Congo, there's someplace else. So we have to deal with the global system of white supremacy and patriarchy, capitalism, in order to dismantle the demon that besieges the planet and humanity. It is only a spoke in that global white supremacist bulwark for white minority global rule. Therefore, if humanity is to survive, then humanity has to destroy its greatest threat. The proposed Atlanta Cop City Uber Police Militarization Training Base and Headquarters is a reincarnation of antebellum South Carolina's Citadel, built in 1842. The Citadel traces its origins to an arsenal constructed by the state of South Carolina to defend white Charlestonians against possible enslaved African uprisings following Denmark Vesey's thwarted rebellion of 1822, which was preceded by Cato's Stono Rebellion in 1739 and the Haitian Revolution in 1791. Now, what does that remind you of? We start talking about, okay, the uprising after George Floyd or the uprising after Mike Brown. It's a progression, brothers and sisters. And until we recognize that it is a progression, and like the cyclical genocide against the Palestinian people or the Haitian people or the Congolese people, then we will remain preoccupied with the same old cyclical distractions. So it becomes necessary that we not allow ourselves to be trapped in that cycle, and instead that we recognize the phenomenons as they emerge. And they themselves have cycles. And that, as they say today, genocides don't just happen, but there are symptoms and symbols leading up to them. There are symptoms and symbols leading up to rising fascism, to genocide, and to the most extreme oppressive forms of coercion known to humanity. Given our abilities to recognize those phenomena and to respond to them is our ability to, as they say, cut them off at the pass. It is in that practice and with that perspective that we defend our movements and we create the space that is necessary for humanity to evolve to the next level. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that insightful talk. The next speakers we're going to have is on the victory around the Alex Saab case. We're going to be having Roger Harris, Task Force of the Americas, and William Caracallo, of the Bolivarian Circles from Venezuela. So take it away.
Alex Saab is free. It was a victory for Venezuelan sovereignty. It was a victory for the sanctions kill movement, the movement against sanctions, and it was a victory for everybody in this room. So I want to tell you a little bit about the story of how we were successful in freeing Alex Saab. He was a diplomat, and he was imprisoned for bringing humanitarian supplies to Venezuela in free, legal, international trade, but in opposition to the illegal U.S. sanctions, sanctions that are imposed over a third of humanity. Over 40 countries are suffering under sanctions. The most severe, of course, are the Palestinians today. The United States wanted more than anything else to lock up Alex Saab and throw away the key, but they were unsuccessful. Because of people like you in this room, and I will go through some of the other elements of that success. His legal team had tried unsuccessfully to free him on the grounds that he was a diplomat. As a diplomat, he's protected by the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. Now, such a diplomat is supposed to enjoy absolute immunity from arrest, even in the time of war. But hey, the world's hegemon does not have to follow the rules of order. They make the rules of order, and they said, no, we don't, even though we are a signatory of the Vienna Convention, we are not going to honor it. Not only that, but this legal team said that he should be freed, yet the United States said, look, we don't even recognize the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro, so why should we recognize his diplomats? So at that point, it looked very bad. But we knew that an international movement, a national movement, and other elements would free him. And we'll go into that in a second. And so what the final way to get him free was that we had a prisoners' exchange. And on December 20th, Alex Saab flew from Miami back to Venezuela. And there he was greeted by his wife, his children, the president's wife, Maduro's wife. It was a beautiful moment. And President Nicolas Maduro made a triumphal public address standing right next to Alex Saab. Now, this was a prisoner exchange, and there were about 10 U.S. prisoners that were exchanged in it. Now, Mr. Biden, he did not make a triumphal address. Particularly, he did not stand with the people who were freed. Now, why didn't he stand with those people that were freed? Well, for one thing, the big ticket item was this guy named Fat Leonard. Probably most of you don't know about Fat Leonard, but he was involved in a corruption scandal that implicated 60 U.S. admirals in the Navy, and they wanted him back really badly. The other people that Biden did not stand along with were two U.S. mercenaries who got it was called on the press the invasion that they had in Venezuela. They tried to assassinate President Maduro. They called the invasion, the press did, the Bay of Piglets. And they, of course, President Biden had no interest in being seen with them at all. So the emancipation of Alex Saab is very similar to the emancipation of the Cuban Five. How many of you have heard of the five Cuban heroes as they've known in Cuba? Yes. And I'm sure many of you worked on that as well. The five Cuban heroes had infiltrated terrorist groups in Miami area, and they were planning attacks on Cuba. So when the Cubans told the United States that there were terrorists in the United States, what the United States did was they arrested the Cuban Five rather than arresting the terrorists, which is par for the course. And that was in 1998, and President Fidel Castro said they would be freed, and they were freed. And in a similar reason, a similar matter, that Alex Saab was freed. There were four elements to the successful campaign of Alex Saab. First was the remarkable resoluteness of Alex Saab. And my comrade, William Kamakaro, who just recently visited with Alex Saab, will be telling you about that story. Two was the mobilization of the entire Venezuelan nation in behalf of Alex Saab. Three was the international movement of which we were the part. And four was the strength of his family, and particularly his wife, Camila Fabri de Saab. And William will be telling us more about that. Now, Alex Saab was kind of unique amongst political prisoners because he had what you might say a get out of jail free card, which he didn't play, and his life was endangered. He was a cancer survivor. He was vomiting blood. He was being tortured. Yet he did not sing, because the United States knew that what Alex Saab was doing was he had circumvented the U.S. sanctions. And because of his actions, food, medicine, and fuel was coming into Venezuela, saving lives. And they knew he had information that could cut off those trade routes. But Alex Saab did not sing. He faced the consequences of death, and he eventually got free. He was a very high-value prisoner for the United States. And the second pillar of the successful campaign to free Alex Saab was the mobilization of the entire Venezuelan nation, from the grassroots all the way up to the top political leadership. The third element was the international campaign. And when I look around the room, there are so many people I know who worked on that campaign. I see Sarah Flounders, who went all the way to Cabo Verde to help free Alex Saab. I was honored to be on part of that international delegation. And there's so many of you that probably I don't know, and that shows how strong that campaign was. Then the fourth pillar of strength of Alex Saab, the one that was really, all four were very important, but was his family, and particularly his wife, Camila Fabri de Saab. She was a young mother, less than 30 years old, with two very young children. She had no political experience, yet out of adversity, she became a political leader in her own right and helped free her husband. And to tell us more about that, I'd like to turn this over to my dear comrade, William Camacaro, from the Alliance for Global Justice. Alex Saab is free.
Yes, I was talking to a friend of ours, Stanfield Smith, and then we were talking for a long time about Alex, and he asked me, do you think that you can get his lawyer numbers? And he said, well, I think so. Let me make some calls. So I start to make calls. One day I make a bunch of calls, and 2 days later, I got a strange call from Venezuela around 12, and I was in a bar, very noisy, and this strange person was asking me, is it true that you want to help Alex Saab? And I was saying, who? Alex Saab. Who is Alex Saab? And then the guy said, okay, bye. And then he said, no, I remember, yes, I want to help Alex Saab. So I went out, and I started to talk to him, and resolved that he was Camila Saab's brother-in-law. And he called me, and I said, well, to start, let's do a webinar with the lawyers. So that was one of the first things that we did, a webinar with some of the lawyers. And then I called first Roger Harris. I called several close people to me at the moment because it was very strange. I spent, after I got the call, a week looking for information about Alex Saab, and there was no information about him. And the first thing that I did is I went to the website of the foreign minister office in Venezuela, and there was no line about him. So there was nothing about him. And I was thinking, this is very strange. How is it possible that a Venezuelan diplomat has been kidnapped 6 months and there is not a single information in any website from the Venezuelan government? And I was very, man, this is rare. Now I understand, because a lot of information has been declassified and people are talking now that basically President Maduro was negotiating at that moment with Trump, and Trump was about to release him. And that's why they didn't make any noise about the fraud case. So we get a bunch of other people involved. And the good thing is that people get, this start to grow by itself, beautiful, around the country, all over. And this is something very important for us, because Alex Saab, at that moment and now, to represent them, it's a hit against the sanctions. It's something that really undermined the power of the sanctions. And for us, was very important to get him out, because Alex Saab, at that time, we're using him as a platform to denounce the sanctions against Venezuela. wasn't very important for us to do that. And I feel that also the, for Venezuelan people was very important, this victory. Was very important for the Venezuelan government that was all the time behind Alexa, something that Julian Assange doesn't have. It was very important for the entire movement. I would say, because my time is over, I would say that we should really take care about these important victories that let us know that, yes, we can. We can win. We are able to win, and that's what happened. Thank you.
All right. The next speaker is on the very important case of Simone Trinidad, Ricardo Palmera. We're going to be having Tom Burke, a longtime friend and comrade of mine, up here and talking about the case. And he'll be representing the committee to free Simone Trinidad.
International.
Solidarity.
International.
Solidarity.
Solidarity. Thank you to UNAC for allowing me to speak today. I especially want to thank Sarah Flounders from Workers' World Party and Jeff Mackler from Socialist Action and all of those here who are part of the movement that kept the anti-war 23 out of prison. I'd rather be here than inside, so thank you very much. And we need to do the same for the Uhuru 3 now. Right on. So I'm going to speak to you about Simone Trinidad, who's a prisoner of the U.S. Empire. He's a Colombian revolutionary, was a leader in the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia People's Army, the FARC-EP. And I just want to say, there's great importance to international solidarity that we're all engaged in. Sometimes, because we're inside the empire, we may feel a little isolated. But I can tell you from traveling to Colombia about 20 years ago on the most dangerous trip I've ever been on with Colombian trade unionists from the oil workers union, that it matters to them. It saves their lives. And what we do here to stop the U.S. war, to stop U.S. intervention, to stop the coup d'etats, to stop the sanctions, makes a big difference over there, and it gives them strength for victory for national liberation struggles. Back in the late 90s, two things were happening in the U.S. One was the U.S. was coming up with what was called Plan Colombia. And a senator named Joe Biden was the main person that introduced Plan Colombia, which was a war plan to the U.S. Senate. It was a plan for misery and death in Colombia. On the other hand, in the middle of this country, there were two comrades. One was Meredith Abbey of the Anti-War Committee and myself in Chicago, who were plotting and planning how to stop this already. And we had the Columbia Action Network to do solidarity work. And one of the best things we came up with was the Coca-Cola boycott, which allowed us to campaign in unions, go to churches and houses of worship, and especially this campaign spread across campuses. Meredith and I were hoping with the Coca-Cola boycott in support of Colombian trade unionists to reach thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people. Instead, it took off like a prairie fire, and we were able to reach first hundreds of thousands and then millions of people with our campaign. My union at the time, the SEIU, Service Employees International, had a 5,000-member convention that signed on to the Coca-Cola boycott and opposed, in our wording, Plan Colombia and said the U.S. should stop funding the war against the FARC and the people of Colombia. So big success. When we organize, we win. So from there, things were developing in Colombia. There were peace negotiations sometimes, but more often there was war against the U.S. and their proxies. You know, the U.S. ran the war in Colombia. Colombian generals were not in charge of the war. It was U.S. generals from Southcom. Someone spoke about that earlier in a workshop. That's who ran the war. That's who gave directions. U.S. intelligence, U.S. weapons. When I stood in front of the largest oil refinery in Colombia with 5,000 workers at 5 in the morning protesting free trade, what did the soldiers wear? They wore U.S. uniforms, and they had Israeli weapons in their hands. That's how this works. So we decided that when Simone Trinidad was captured, we needed to do a campaign to free Simone Trinidad. So who is he? He is a Colombian revolutionary who at the age of 37 left the life he knew. He comes from a bourgeois family, from a family that ran jewelry shops, were bankers. He went to the Naval Academy of Colombia's government. He quit a month before he graduated because he decided to take the path of trying to reform the system and organize people. And he did that for years. He joined the Patriotic Union, a political party, which had 4,000-plus members killed by death squads. It was an attempt by the revolutionary movement and reformist groups to unite the left and elect people to power that would change things. But instead, it was attacked by death squads and assassins and never succeeded. When most of his friends that he knew and grew up with were either dead or forced to flee to other countries like Sweden, he decided to go join the FARC at the age of 37. I think that's a pretty amazing thing for someone at that age to go do. And he fought with them for many years. Eventually, he was part of their peace negotiation processes and helped tremendously to advance the negotiations within Colombia to try to get a just and lasting peace. But it wasn't to be. So later, he decided that the FARC needed to negotiate with the UN, and he left and went to Ecuador on his way to meet with Kofi Annan's representatives at the UN when the U.S. and Colombian intelligence captured him, and he was extradited to Washington, D.C., to a jail. This violates the sovereignty of Colombia or any country that has extradition treaties with the U.S. In the case of Alex Saab, there is no extradition treaty, but the U.S. did it anyway. They don't follow any international law. They just make it up as they go. So in Washington, D.C., he was eventually put on trial in a federal courtroom, and we went to that courtroom. Four times he was put on trial, right? The first trial ended in a hung jury, and the judge declared that no one was allowed to talk about the case to outside of the courtroom to have anything to say about it. Well, before the second case began, the defense attorney, who was quite good, had figured out that the judge and the prosecutor had discussed the case because the U.S. prosecutor slipped up. So the judge was forced to step down from those trials because they were caught cheating, trying to prosecute Simone Trinidad and lock him away. And we were there to witness it, and we were there to tell the media about it, and it made big news in Latin America and all around the Caribbean and especially in Colombia. So we exposed the sham that the U.S. justice system is. That's where the case of the anti-war 23 actually begins. The FBI began investigating us because the judge was angry at us and started coming after us at that point. So everything ties together once you study it and figure out what's happening. So after four trials, two on drug charges, two on terrorism charges, Simone Trinidad was found guilty of one charge related to, a big surprise, being a member of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which apparently is a crime in the U.S. courtrooms. So the judge gave him a 70-year sentence. They enhanced everything. He's at the peace negotiations with a rifle on his shoulder. That enhances the charges by 7 years. So they just throw everything onto it. So now he's a prisoner in the Florence, Colorado Supermax. That's a torture prison for anyone who's inside of it. There is no fresh air. It's only solitary confinement, the type where you don't even get to interact with the guards, right? Everything's done remotely, and you're by yourself the whole time. But through our struggle and through supporting him and through the peace process that happened in Colombia, he now has relative freedom in the prison. He can get books and reading materials. He can have conversations with some select other prisoners. And he gets to see his lawyer, Mark Burton, regularly. So where we're at today is things have changed a lot in Colombia. The peace process was not all that good for the FARC. They've splintered into 2.5 other armed groups. Their political groups that came out splintered into now 3 different parties. It's hard and difficult for us to find someone in Colombia to campaign to free Simón Trinidad. He was not included in the peace negotiations and set free, which would have been the time to do it. But we're still campaigning for him. We still stand with him. There's a mass movement that's emerged in Colombia that is very repressed, violently repressed still. They're still killing people every week. There's over 400 former FARC combatants who have been murdered by death squads. But people persist and are struggling and advancing the mass movement there. It's resulted in the election of a leftist president who's named Petro, and he is key for us going forward. We need to get President Petro to demand the freedom of Simón Trinidad so we can join him and build a movement here to force Biden to free Simón Trinidad. Thank you for your time. Solidarity.
Thank you very much, Tom, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this important case in the future. So at this point, we're going to hear some words about Julian Assange. We're going to have Colleen Raleigh, I believe, a very, very well-known person, FBI whistleblower. She's going to be talking for the Twin Cities Assange defense. Come up here. Give it up for Colleen. It's good to see you up here.
Well, since we started this last perpetual war, of course, there's been wars before this, but this last one began with 9/11. A lot of good, bad, and ugly for me personally, but the best part for me is I've gotten to meet a lot of the people who have fought against this repression. Two of them are deceased. Pete Seeger, I got to meet him personally. I got to go to his 90th birthday party. And, you know, he lost everything during the end of the Vietnam War. He lost his entire career. He was completely blackballed for many years. And even the Smothers Brothers had to censor him. Then I met Daniel Ellsberg. And so he was this great, I'll talk more about him. The third one I had the great honor and privilege to meet was Julian Assange. And I and other retired intelligence professionals went in, you know, not midway, but maybe at the beginning with when he was already in custody in the, he wasn't in custody, but he was in asylum in the Ecuador embassy consulate for the first couple of years. My group gave him an award, and it wasn't an award for journalism, as what, 20-some other major journalist groups, press groups, have given him. You never hear this on NPR when they're talking about it. If it's ever brought up, he's never, ever called someone who is a journalist and who a publisher who's won numerous awards for publications. No, we gave him an award for integrity in intelligence. And the first person, the first two people who ran up to him to hand him our award were Daniel Ellsberg and Craig Murray, the former UK ambassador, when he gave a talk in a press venue in the UK. They quick ran up and gave him the award. Then later, we went into the Ecuadorian embassy and had later talks about this. One thing that people, I guess I should update Assange case right now, for people who don't know, although he's become such an iconic, almost an iconic, I hate to say the word, but he's an iconic martyr right at this point, because they are absolutely intent on martyring him, whether he's convicted or not. He's not convicted of anything. They've held him one way or the other for like 12 years now. 12 years. And that would actually take the life out of most people. And it is having, you know, he's in Belmarsh, which is a really bad, torturous prison. And it's running a toll on him. He's had a stroke already. And so it's not good at all. But he's still hanging in there. And there are people fighting for him, including the same things that you just mentioned for other people. His wife, his family, I mean, the international groups, the journalists, a lot of important. The thing that he has going for him is, you know what? This turns out to be freedom of press. So actually, even the New York Times and the Guardian and El Mundo and the major newspapers of the world they almost have to say they want him free. They have to say that. But unfortunately, they think they're in the club. You know, you guys were calling it, people called it the establishment. They call it, what was the other terms for Washington, D.C. these days? The ruling class. Okay, I think the better name for this is the blob. The blob. I like that better. But that blob, which actually is headquartered in Washington, D.C., maybe a little bit in Israel, too, and some in NATO. But that blob, in times of war, so, you know, when we're not in a war, when we're kind of in a lull before this last perpetual war, we forget. You know, we think we have freedom of assembly. Here we are. We're kind of taking that for granted, freedom of association. All those years, at least I'm going to be 70, and all those years after Vietnam, I think we took it for granted that there was some freedom of speech and freedom of press. The newspapers for sure thought that you could publish the Pentagon Papers. Why did they think that you could do that without having the government stop you, as they did with WikiLeaks and other groups? Why did they think that? Because there's a Supreme Court case. They took that to the Supreme Court and they won. But guess what? That's over now. That's over now. That, you know, what people have said. Not only international law, the Vienna Conventions, the Geneva Conventions, all of the international law that I studied, not only is that over, but our domestic law is over too. And the main pillar for our ability to unite, we talked about uniting, building movements. The main pillar of that is the First Amendment. Freedom of speech, press, and association. When that goes up in smoke, as they are attempting to do, and they're attempting to do that by martyring Julian Assange, and also by complete censorship. People mentioned the word disinformation. Okay, there is a disinformation complex right now. And it's a big business. They're going to give college degrees for disinformation. And the funny thing is, if your Democrats are in power, then certain things are disinformation, you know, whatever. If you're Republicans, wait a minute, I'll just give an example. When the Democrats were in power, the big disinformation was Russiagate. Okay, so Russiagate was all a hoax. But we had to listen to Rachel Maddow every night talking about this. These were all lies. So disinformation by the blob is they can come up with anything. They can say anything is untrue. And this is in times of war. We have the Espionage Act from 1917 when Woodrow Wilson decided he was going to go to war, and Debs and others were all against it. He had to turn all of his supporters, who he had promised peace to, into warmongers. And he did that by passing the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act and they started putting all of the people that were against war into jail. It is happening again. It happened during Vietnam again. It reared its ugly head. That's why we had Daniel Ellsberg. I will just say one other thing here, which is that if we want the truth, remember what Julian Assange, his famous quote is, if lies can start wars, then the truth should be able to end them. The Pentagon Papers did a fair job, actually, of ending the Vietnam War. It played a role in that. And that was the whole theory. But now with the disinformation complex, they have to manipulate your minds. And they do that through censorship of the truth. How many reporters have watched 11, 12 years of what happened to Julian Assange and say, I'm going to be brave and I'm going to write about the truth of this matter? Well, you're going to be, first of all, you'll be fired in a New York second. I and another Minnesotan are going to go on the Gaza flotilla here. And, you know, pretty darn, you know what? It's not only scary, whatever, but one would think it could be newsworthy, right? We were told already indirectly by our major newspaper here, it's not newsworthy. And why is it not newsworthy? It's because of this repression and disinformation that we're living in. So whistleblowers, and Daniel Ellsberg was a great example, there is no ability to get the truth out if you go to the press and they say, no, we don't want to know. They put their hands over their ears. We won't publish that. It's not newsworthy. Actually, Daniel Ellsberg had that experience. He went for like a year or two, and he had the papers right with him, and nobody would publish them for a while. So that's the kind of situation we're in. And we need more people. I'm going to end on a more positive note. This has become a millstone around Biden. Biden knows that they do not have a legal leg to stand on to imprison a publisher. Okay? And also, our whole democracy goes up in smoke. Our rule of law, everything. Everything depends on the First Amendment. Our ability to share information. Everything ends if we don't have the First Amendment. That was the Thomas Jefferson knew that. And Biden knows, so that what he's trying to do is push it to the election. And hoping, of course, that maybe, you know, Assange might stroke out or something. But they're trying to push this off. And this is why, for all the activism that we can do, it is a time when we can have an impact. So if more people... I still think that, maybe there's some decent person left in government. And if we could fall on that person, if we could get more whistleblowers, if we could get the press, by the way, if we could even get the ACLU, who is keeping quiet about this because they're part of this whole repression too. So anyway, we need to do more. And at the very least, remember what's at stake. It's about our ability to even have a conference.
Thank you, Colleen. Extremely informative. Thank you. Free him at once. Absolutely correct. Now, we're going to have, at some point, we're going to have discussion, questions, answers, and all that kind of thing. But before we get there, we're going to have one final and extremely important speaker. And that's about the issue of Muslim political prisoners in the United States, of which there are many. And Mel Underbaki, who's going to be joining me in a second, longtime friend, is going to be addressing this critical issue that's affected so many in the community. So give it up for Mel. And by the way, she's with the National Coalition for Civil Freedoms, an extremely important and excellent group. Here we are.
Yes, thank you very much.
I have my cell phone
okay.
Here. Sorry, Frank.
Is this good? Can everybody hear me? Yeah, I guess you can. First, our basic mission for the Coalition for Civil Freedoms is to advocate for the rights of political prisoners who were targeted in the war on terror. So I'm going to start with the beginning and tell you how we got our start. And it's going to be from my point of view. There's lots of different points of view of this one. But my first exposure to all of this was in Tampa, Florida, when one of my colleagues at the University of South Florida was charged with terrorism. And this was Dr. Samuel Arian, who was tenured, highly respected, award-winning, etc., but he was also a political activist working quite effectively for the rights of Palestinians. So Friends of Human Rights was formed to advocate for him at that time. He was in pretrial in solitary confinement for 2.5 years. So almost every day, his wife Nala and I took a nice walk along the Hillsborough River, and she told me what was happening to him in prison, and I could not believe it. I was shocked. So this was all new to me then, and this is before he had a trial, and things like he was strip searched every time he entered or left his cell. His treatment was unbelievable. And the six-month trial was equally shocking. I was there every day, and it was really a theater of the absurd. And if it hadn't been real, it would have been funny. It was that absurd. And the jury agreed, and they were unanimous that Sammy was not a terrorist. But because the two of the jurors did not want to completely acquit him, the government was able to continue its vendetta against him, and it was 7 more years before he obtained his freedom. So there was a Norwegian filmmaker, Lene Halvorsen, made an excellent film about the trial called USA versus Al Arian. And my partner and I took this film around the country, and in the process, we learned that Sammy was not the only one that this was happening to. In every town, we met people who had a loved one who had been unjustly imprisoned. So at about the same time, the people who now make up our legal team, Steve Downs and Kathy Manley, were involved in another very unjust case against Yassin Aref, who was an imam in Albany, New York. He and his co-defendant, Mohammed Hossein, were entrapped by an FBI informant in a fabricated case. And Project Salaam was formed there to advocate for these two men. Now, Steve and Kathy also started investigating, and they were also struck by the large number of unjust arrests around the country in terrorism cases. So in 2010, Sammy was on house arrest. He brought his Friends of Human Rights, Project Salaam, and 16 other organizations together in his daughter's apartment where she had custody of her father, and the Coalition for Civil Freedoms was born. And at the time, it was called the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms. So after 9/11, the FBI was tasked with preventing the next terror attack, and so they started looking for terrorists everywhere. One of their early targets were influential people, particularly those who advocated for Palestine. So an example of that type of case was Sammy's case, and the hope was to silence him. Another similar case was the Holy Land Five. So the Holy Land Foundation was the largest Islamic charity in the United States at the time, and some of their charity went to help people in Palestine. And so, of course, that had to be stopped. And it took two trials, but they managed to convict them. The two co-founders, Ghassan Alashi and Shukri Abubakar, who were 50 years old at the time, were both convicted and sentenced to 65 years in prison. So this amounts to a life sentence. And these are two very good men taken out of commission for us. Yeah. So it turned out that these early terrorists were very hard to find, so the FBI had to get creative. One popular way to find terrorists is to send informants into mosques to befriend vulnerable people, usually young men, and goad them into saying something stupid and recording these things to play to a jury later on. So there were several cases in Tampa early on. One of those was a classic entrapment case. Sammy Asmacock was a young man who was mentally ill and very vulnerable. So informants sent by the FBI befriended him, got him a job, gave him money, bought him food, and they started goading him into a terrorist plot. So these informants planned everything, and Sammy did nothing. But they put an AR-15 into his hands, and they filmed him swearing allegiance to Al-Qaeda. They showed that film to the jury, and the jury convicted him. And he was sentenced to 41 years. and for speech, basically. Yeah. Sammy's immigrant family, who had been doing very well with a successful bakery and a house, but they lost everything in paying for the lawyer. And I think the last 2 points I wanted to make, this ongoing war and terror kicked into high gear after 9/11. Now the genocide in Gaza is providing another rationale for depriving people of their civil rights. As FBI Director Wray recently said, that this will increase domestic radicalization for years to come, that our biggest threat is homegrown terrorists. And that, by that he meant Americans. So now they're looking for terrorists on college campuses, among the people who are opposed to genocide, on the streets, among people, again, who are out protesting. And informants are continuing to infiltrate mosques, looking for idealistic but easily influenced young people in order to manufacture even more terrorist plots. So our coalition has a database with over 1,000 cases like this. Entrapment and preemptive prosecution of very vulnerable and naive people turned out to be an easy way for the FBI to look like they were doing something to keep us safe.
All right, so now begin discussion and questions, points people wish to raise.
Hello. My name's Joe. I'm with the DFW Anti-War Committee. As Tamara mentioned during her panel, 23 people were arrested shutting down General Dynamics in Garland, Texas. We shut down General Dynamics for 6 hours. My question to y'all is, the arrestees have voted to launch a defense campaign, and I wanted to ask if there's anything that you'd wish you'd known at the beginning of a defense campaign. Thank you.
Yeah, I think at the beginning of the defense campaign, the most important thing is the defendants. Are the defendants willing to speak out? Are they willing to make themselves known? And are they willing to be effective advocates on their own behalf? I don't think it's possible to run a defense campaign where somebody doesn't want to be on TV. It's not possible to run an effective one, in my opinion, anyway, like that. So I think the attitude of the defendants is very important. I think number two, the legal strategy needs to be determined by the defendants. They're the ones who are going to do the time. The lawyers are not. And we have political objectives, and our view cannot possibly be a narrow legal point of view. Important cases in any event are won in the court of public opinion, and that is the most vital factor. That becomes operative, though, through what the defendants do and having an effective legal strategy, what we call the shots. And those would be my basic points. But any other people wish to speak?
Thank you. You know, there's a tendency to think, and perhaps in many instances it is the case, that things happen and people get arrested spontaneously. But in my opinion, and certainly throughout the civil rights movement, everything was, to the extent that it could be, was planned. And the most successful outcomes come from when there has been significant planning involved, including who's going to get arrested. That it's not just someone who wants to get arrested, who has no idea what is down the road. In fact, SNCC was one of the first, if not the first, organization that initiated the jail no bail policy. So it wasn't like you were going to go to jail and get out the next day. You were expected to stay there, and not only were you expected to stay there, but you were expected to go along with the strategy that other members of that committee came up with as a part of the advancement of the issue, because the issue is far more important than the individual.
Any other panelists? Otherwise, we'll take more points.
And it was one of the classic cases you spoke of where there was an informant who got them to say, we're told a pledge to Al-Qaeda. And I know it took several trials to convict them. Do you know what case I'm talking about?
Mel, can you speak to that?
Yeah, I thought you were talking about the Liberty City 7 case.
That's it, yes.
Okay. I know the so-called ringleader, Narciso Batiste, he's out now. He's on, I haven't, and he's got it. Last I heard, he was doing things like, painting houses, inside houses, fancy painting. So he was doing well, the last that I heard. There's also a really good movie about that case. The one, he was acquitted. I think the person who was acquitted in the first trial got deported. The Day Shall Come? Okay, the movie is The Day Shall Come, if you can see it. It's a very funny satire on these kinds of cases, and it's based on Narciso Batiste. Yeah, Chris Morris was the filmmaker. Just, probably not what you asked, but he's not in jail anymore.
You know, we got four of the five of the Milwaukee Five, you know, sitting right here. You know, like I said, our first court appearance was on a Thursday. We pled not guilty. Yeah. But, you know, we have, many, many people in our ears, you know, from the lawyer, just, you know, even our parents, friends, you know, what have you, you know, just wanting us to get it over with, you know, plead guilty, take the fine, whatever it may be. I was wondering if any of y'all might have something to say on that respect.
And perhaps I spoke too quickly, but the question becomes, why did you get arrested if it was such an inconvenience? If it's an issue that is important, then there's a campaign, and getting arrested is a part of the advancement of that issue. So if an individual is not committed to the issue, then you don't get arrested. There are lots of other things that people who want to work on an issue can do short of getting arrested. And they're the things that should be done as opposed to getting arrested. So I'm a jail no bail person, so that it becomes what harm is done to the issue as a result of taking a plea deal and getting it over, to use your language. Sometimes, for instance, in civil cases, settlements are made with the idea that there are certain structural changes, which are usually cosmetic, that are a part of the settlement. Like, you know, they're going to have a citizens review board for all the people that the cops kill, which none of which ever work or have any meaning or stop folks from getting killed. But at least there's something that requires the state to infer that they need to do something different. So it sort of kind of undermines their credibility and the general public's heretofore unshakable belief in their veracity and trustworthiness. But short of that, we have to be more disciplined in our approach to actions.
I'll just add, Julian Assange right now, his attorneys there's talk of a plea deal. You know, I don't know, to be honest, if he would agree. And the truth is, he's on the side of the law. He did nothing illegal, and he's got in the terms of the issue, he's on the right side in of everything. So, you know, if he gives up, it was simply because, you know, after all these years, it wears you down. The only one who can make those decisions are, don't let the attorneys, I would say, don't let the attorneys talk you into stuff. If it's, you know, community service and picking up trash for a week or something, okay, that's a good thing too, picking up trash. But, you know, if it's going to be 70 years and you're in the right, you know, that's a whole different story.
No, it's not on this question. I just felt a panel like this, it's always good to repeat again for everyone what to do if the FBI knocks, just as a separate point, and what to do if you're arrested, how to, you know, there's a few do's and don'ts that are good always to state. So before the session ends, several of you here have really firsthand experience, and it is good to recap that point.
All right, I want to talk about the question of pleas. This is just, it's simply my opinion. And the reality is that there is different kinds of charges, right? There's some things where you do CD and you actually know what the consequences might be and that kind of thing. And you have cases where, that I've worked on, for example, that of Carlos Montes, where it basically was a strike out of the blue. It was related to my case, Tom, and others. But here we have a person, founder of the Brown Berets, suddenly he has a trumped-up firearms charge, and he's facing 10 years in prison. And it's an extremely set of serious things, and it all revolves around a set of legal technicalities. At the end of the day, what we did is we pled for 1 year of probation. And I think that was an outstanding victory for the people's movements, as opposed to him being marched off to prison, which a lot of people thought was the most likely outcome. I think people who are our defendants, you need to take a serious look at it, especially when those charges are severe charges. For example, the many material support charges that Mel has dealt with. This stuff is extremely serious.
Really quickly then, everybody here remembers, or they should, Section 1021 of the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act provides, and this was argued in court with Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, the DOJ asserted that they could imprison anybody, civilians or otherwise, into military detention just for their expressive activities, meaning their free speech. And it's been a year ago, two years ago, Shireen Abu Akla was shot by Israeli Defense Force officers, and of course journalists are routinely being killed in Gaza now. So the U.S. military law of war manual provides that the U.S. military can kill journalists on the basis that they may weaken our morale. So this is how totalitarian this is. This fight really has to be brought forward continuously and demand free speech, First Amendment rights, free press rights, because that's what's at stake, totalitarianism or not.
All right. Writing back from Chicago.
There's a civil case going on in New York right now against the CIA. I wonder, Colleen, could you comment on that? And also the Yahoo News report that Pompeo and the CIA was reported to have planned to assassinate or kidnap Julian Assange.
Yes. Usually in the case of the government committing a serious illegal act, a case has to be dismissed. And this goes back to, 1920s. There was a famous case where Justice Brandeis said, when the government becomes the wrongdoer, You have to stop it, and otherwise it breeds chaos. That's another one of the laws that we're supposed to have that's gone up in smoke. Because you actually lose evidence if you do something wrong. In the Ellsberg case, when they broke into his psychiatrist's office, the case was dismissed. In the case of Assange, they not only surveilled him illegally, but they actually plotted to assassinate him. That's one of many reasons this case has no legs. And yet, because of the situation we're in this country, we've talked about it on many levels, that we have a large public opinion tipping point, and yet that blob in Washington is not listening, or they have their hands over their ears.
All right. So with that, we are
Rick,
going...
Rick, quickly. Hello.
What's that?
Back here.
Me. Okay.
Hi. I'm sorry. I got to say
something. Rosemary Williams, you have
yes,
less than a minute.
My brother, real quick. You know, thousands of people, young people, came out when Floyd was killed. New activists. But they haven't really been connected. Because nobody really knew about this conference in the Twin Cities. There would have been probably 1,000 more people here. So we got to find a way to bring the social justice, the anti-war coalition, all of us together, particularly with these young people, like we did in the 60s, and have these Saturday sessions so they can learn and be connected and know what to do. Because a lot of old people in here, we can't keep this going by ourselves. So please be more inclusive with these young activists that are out here that want to be active. That's all I got to say.
Right. Thank you, Rosemary. And for those of you who don't know, Rosemary stood at the head of a very dramatic struggle in the Twin City around the issue of housing. And she's truly an example to many. So, Rosemary, it's great to have you here. So, by way of a conclusion, effective movements do face repression. And we certainly can and will defeat it. What Sarah said is extremely important. And I will repeat it one last time. No good can ever come of talking to the FBI. In fact, not so long ago, I'm going to say maybe less than a month ago, the FBI was out taking a look at the issue of people supporting Venezuela down in Chicago. Don't talk to the FBI. Some people will say, well, your attorney will call, blah, 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 blah. Your attorney's going to tell you the same thing. Don't talk to the FBI. That's really as simple as that.